Number 16, Physician and Patient. Matthew 9, verse 12, Mark 2, verse 17, Luke 5, verse 31. Jesus had an encounter with the scribes in Capernaum. A palsied man was brought to him, born of four, and Jesus, seeing their faith, said to him, "Be of good cheer. Thy sins be forgiven thee." The man's condition was probably due to a life of excess, and Jesus knew the man's mind was as sick as his body. Sin and evil are as closely connected as cause and effect, ultimately, if not always, proximately. The scribes were watching Jesus and noting his words. Perceiving their evil thought, he asked them, which was easier, to say, "Thy sins be forgiven," or to say, "Rise up and walk"? The first was easier to foresay, for there could be no disproof. The second produced a visible effect, by which the power of the speaker's words was put to the proof. To establish his power to forgive sins, Jesus then commanded the man to get up, take up his mat, and go to his house. This healing of sickness is seen to be a real proof that sin was forgiven. When the causal connection of sin and suffering is remembered. In this episode, therefore, Jesus is shown to be a healer of both soul and body. Jesus next calls Matthew, the tax collector, and accepts an invitation to his house. The Pharisees, discomfited in their complaint about Jesus forgiving sins, now attack his disciples. "Why eateth your master with publicans and sinners?" they ask. Jesus, hearing it, protected the disciples by answering the question. His answer is tinged with irony and contains a rebuke. "They that be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick." That is so, obviously. But the real point is that Jesus takes them at their own estimate of themselves. They did not think that they were morally sick. They did not therefore feel the need for the ministrations of Jesus. But they should not grumble at him for going to those who recognized their need. How far their own assessment of themselves was wrong, Jesus makes evident by the next saying, "But go ye and learn what that meaneth. I will have mercy and not sacrifice. For I am not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." This must have been sternly uttered, for it contains a strong rebuke. "Go, learn." And they were the teachers of the people. But how truly did they need to learn that mercy is greater than sacrifice? God required sacrifice indeed, but much more did he require that they should exercise mercy. The quotation, Hosea 6 verse 6, was apposite, for in the context in Hosea, God says he will hide himself till they acknowledge their offence and seek him. Chapter 5, verse 15. The response of Israel in their affliction is foretold. They will say, "Come, and let us return unto the Lord, for he hath torn, and he will heal us. He hath smitten, and he will bind us up." 6 verse 1. God would have healed Israel before, but their iniquity stood in the way. Chapter 7 verse 1. Ephraim saw his sickness, and Judah his wound, but they went to the Assyrian. "Yet could he not heal you." Chapter 5 verse 13. But though Israel wrought self-destruction, God declared, "In me is thine help." Chapter 13, verse 9. God would be Israel's physician. In Jesus, God had drawn near, and the use of the figure by Jesus takes up the Old Testament allusions to God's work. By his stripes we are healed. For by his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities. Isaiah 53, verse 11. Parables of the Messiah, number 17, the Bridegroom. Matthew 9, verse 15, Mark 2, verse 19, Luke 5, verses 33 and 34. In the New Testament, John the Baptist is the first to use the figure of the bridegroom. The occasion was when his disciples told him of the success that was attending the teaching of Jesus. All men come to him. John knew that both his baptism and that of Jesus were of God, and in that large view there was no room for envy. Nor did John show any. On the contrary, his relationship to Jesus excluded it. He was the friend of the bridegroom. He that hath the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom which standeth and heareth him rejoiceth greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. This my joy therefore is fulfilled. John 3, verse 29. The friend was the groomsman who sought the hand of the bride and arranged the marriage. When the task was crowned with success and he heard the voice of the bridegroom welcoming the bride, his joy was full. So John, the friend, rejoiced to hear that the people were seeking Jesus and were being welcomed by him as the bridegroom welcomes the bride. Later, John's disciples, possibly at the instigation of the Pharisees, compare Matthew 9:14 and Mark 2, verse 18, came to Jesus with the question, "Why do the disciples of John and of the Pharisees fast, but not the disciples of Jesus?" There was more than one reason, which Jesus gave them in the form of three short parables: the bridegroom, the patched cloth, the wineskins. The first of these we now consider. Can you make the children of the bride chamber fast while the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken away from them, and then shall they fast in those days. Luke 5, verse 33 and 34. It has been remarked that whereas John, who lived in Judea, spoke of the friend of the bridegroom, John 3, verse 29, Jesus, who lived in Galilee, spoke of sons of the bride chamber. The former refers to a practice common in Judea, but not followed in Galilee. The latter was a general term for all invited guests. There is perfect accuracy in the detail in the record. When Jesus referred to himself as the bridegroom, he was first of all reminding the disciples of John of the answer of their own teacher. John had the joy of the groomsman. The disciples of Jesus had the freedom and joy of the friends and guests at the wedding. By rabbinic law, the marriage week was a time of unmixed festivity. Even the ordinances of the strict fast of the Day of Atonement were modified. Everything had to serve the purpose of bringing gladness to bride and bridegroom. In the same way, the presence of Jesus then was itself the occasion and reason for joy. But, and with that word we see that Jesus recognized that the joy would be short-lived, and he then gives the first public hint of the appointed end of his ministry when he said that the bridegroom would be taken away. Then, not of command, but arising from the sense of loss, would his disciples fast. We look at the customs of the land of Palestine of the days of Christ's ministry for the atmosphere of these sayings. But it would be a mistake to restrict our inquiries to manners and customs. They only give the adjuncts, the trimmings of the story. The heart of the story, the very basis of the thought of Jesus, goes back to Old Testament teaching. Isaiah chapter 54 compared Jerusalem of the past, under the law of Hagar, and Jerusalem of the future, under the Messiah, to Sarah. Like Hagar, the city was to be cast off, verse 6, Revised Version. But like Sarah, it was also to have children of promise, all spirit-begotten. God says, "Thy Maker is thine husband. The Lord of hosts is his name, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. The God of the whole earth shall he be called." Verse 5. The dullest of Isaiah's listeners must have seen in these words a reference to one in whom God would be manifested, a redeemer of Zion and its people, and a ruler over the whole world. The Messiah is the maker and husband, as in a sense the first Adam was the maker and husband to Eve. Jeremiah also uses the figure, "Turn, O backsliding children, for I am married unto you." God was bridegroom to Israel. Psalm 45 is the marriage ode of the king, who is addressed as, "O God, whose throne is for ever and ever, and whose queen is in gold of Ophir, in clothing of wrought gold." Psalm 19 tells of the heavens declaring God's glory, in which the sun is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. The former is by both apostolic and rabbinic interpretation applied to the Messiah, the latter by Paul in Romans 10. The Song of Solomon is a sustained allegory based upon the figure of marriage, which also was given a messianic significance by the teachers of Israel. When John applied the figure of bridegroom to Jesus, and Jesus also made use of it in reference to himself, there was implied a claim that Jesus was Israel's Messiah, and that he was a manifestation of God, and one to whom the true Israel was related as wife. Parables of the Messiah, number 18, The Patched Cloth. Matthew 9, verse 16, Mark 2, verse 21, Luke 5, verse 36. When the disciples of John and of the Pharisees inquired of Jesus concerning fasting, his answer consisted of three small parables. The first concerns the bridegroom. The second is based on the patching of clothes. In Matthew 9, verse 16 and Mark 2, verse 21, Jesus is recorded as saying that no one puts a piece of new, raw or unfulled cloth on an old garment, for the new piece would pull away and the rent be made worse. Luke's version of the parable speaks of a piece of a new garment being used as a patch, both new and old garments being spoiled. Perhaps in the full reply of Jesus, of which the gospel records can only be a summary, Jesus used both ideas, or more probably, As papyri evidence indicates, the unfulled cloth of Matthew or Mark was a colloquial term for new garment. An interesting picture of the boyhood of Jesus has been put together from his sayings. In the cottage home with 8 or 9 mouths to feed, it may have been an anxious Mary that plied her needle to keep her children clothed and tidy. It may be that a suitable patch was not available, and one of the children suggested that another garment too large for immediate use might be cut to supply the patch. It is a child's solution to a pressing need. The meaning in general terms is clear. The teaching of Jesus was bringing something new as a way of life, and it could not be used to patch up the old forms of Judaism. The two ways of life were incompatible, and any effort to repair the defects of Judaism by the teaching of Jesus would be disastrous for both. Is there anything in the figure of a garment that takes us further than the homely idea of childhood's days? There is here, as in most of the teaching of Jesus, an Old Testament background. Man has been interested in garments since Adam transgressed God's law and sought by a fig leaf device to cover his shame. But the clothing man invented did not exhibit the divine principles on which alone sin could be covered. God therefore provided Adam with clothing of skins, illustrating the divine rule that sin could only be covered by blood shedding. This lesson has to be learned by all who would become acceptable to God. Abel discerned it, and by faith offered an acceptable sacrifice. The record in Genesis briefly indicates that worship was not left to man's arrangement. God revealed the way men must approach. At the time appointed, at the end of days, margin, by means commanded, a firstling, offered in the way required, with the fat, Genesis 4, verse 3 and 4, so Abel in faith came to worship God, and he could have said, as David long afterwards wrote, "Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered." The clothing of the high priest was an elaborate parable of the preparation of the Lord himself for his office of priest. See Law of Moses chapter 18. Isaiah chapter 61 connects this priestly clothing with the anointed of the Lord. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. I will greatly rejoice in the Lord. My soul shall be joyful in my God. For he hath clothed me with the garments of salvation. He hath covered me with the robes of righteousness, as a bridegroom decketh." That is, robes as a priest, see Authorized Version margin, "himself with ornaments, and as a bride adorneth herself with jewels," verses 1 and 10. Here the figures of bridegroom and clothing are brought together by Isaiah in a way that could have suggested the same combination in the Lord's answer to the question of John's disciples. But this is not all. The Lord's anointed uses both the figure of bride and bridegroom to illustrate his clothing. The mystical Christ indeed includes both, and therefore in the same context in Isaiah, he gives the mourners beauty for ashes, verse 3, where beauty is the same word as ornaments in verse 10. Clothing in a closely related figure in Isaiah 6 verse 1 stands for the priests of the age to come who are associates of the king, and the figure is used also of Zion's children, with which she will be clothed as with an ornament, as a bride doeth. Chapter 49, verse 18. Beautiful garments, which she will put on when she responds to the Lord's command to awake. 52, verse 1. In contrast to this divine clothing, Isaiah compares human schemes, plans of worship, and ways of life to spiders' webs, unsuitable material for clothing. Their webs shall not become garments, neither shall they cover themselves with their works. Chapter 59, verses 5 and 6. Israel, in the day of their shame, when Messiah is revealed, will recognize this at last and confess, "All our righteousnesses are as filthy rags." Chapter 64, verse 6. Jude warns the saints to avoid such a state, hating even the garment spotted by the flesh. Verse 23. Paul uses the figure of clothing when he instructs the Colossians that as they had put off the old man and put on the new man, they must eschew the deeds of one and cultivate the grace of the other. This selection of references shows the Bible philosophy of clothes and the impossibility, to use Carlyle's figure of Sartor Restatus, for the man to retailor his clothes. The Old Testament references also providing the background of thought to the Lord's parable of the patched garment.